Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I'm not here now. I'm about a few hundred miles south, visiting family in the land of California. But I recorded this. And I will start off with something that I wrote. Actually, everything on this half hour is what I have written over time and have read on this program once or twice or more. And so therefore, the disclaimer that this next half hour is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only, in the entire cosmos and multiple universes. I'll start off with May Day. May Day. A call for rebellion, a call for change, a call for help. May Day. The ancient celebration of spring, the festival of rebirth. May Day is celebrated all over the world in every culture and kitchen. For many, it is Labor Day in honor of the anonymous billions who break their backs or wear out their nerves for their daily bread. It is the symbol of seeding the earth in hope of a good harvest to ease the dreadful hunger that stalks the human race. May Day is also a day of revolution, a charge against history that demands sweeping changes among the world's societies. This claim usually originates from compassion and the perception that there is no excuse for anyone to go hungry, be without shelter, or denied adequate health and medical care. It is the demand for freedom and respect of all the world's people. The world situation perpetually eludes optimists and idealists. The balance of wealth and distribution of resources is dismally inequitable, which intensifies the disparity between rich and poor. Millions are out of work, their lives ruined by poverty and economic collapse. Millions more die from famine and epidemics. Oppression, tyranny, and corruption infect the world's governments. World leaders move pitilessly against their own peoples and their neighbors. Armies and police kill innocent people in retaliation for terrorist acts, which perpetuates terrorism. Populations are the major targets of wars, contrary to pious perfidy, which makes war itself a foremost and persistent act of enormous terrorism. The terror of nuclear annihilation looms iconically 66 years after the first atomic bombs obliterated two Japanese cities and gave birth to the nuclear age. We have built a global greenhouse and we dwell within. We have pummeled and plundered our home planet as if it offered an inexhaustible feast without charge or cleanup. But the consequences of our careless and excessive indulgence are converging approximate with our disregard and denial. Our probable proximity to extinction is not from any single cause or danger or combination of them, but because we seem helpless as well as unwilling to undo the damage or change direction. Our paradox is that our opulent civilization is based on processes that threaten to obliterate it. We will most likely strangle on the effluence of our affluence. The millennium is an X-ray of our history which lies behind us like an immense junkyard that seems cluttered with artifacts of no use to us anymore. We try to escape history as if by accelerating past we are Teflon. But history brought us to where we are and made us who we are. This new millennium evokes old prophecies. Apocalyptic cults that believe the end of history is at hand flourish and seize theolytical power all over the world. Inexorable bipolar dogmata armed with the means to achieve what ancient prophecy continues to incite. The poets might be right after all. The prospect of peace is more irrational than the dark, brooding desire for murder each of us hosts like a malevolent gene. Humanity's penchant for sinister error, folly, mass psychosis, and loathsome horror gives us our sense of humor, our appreciation of the comedy of inescapable death. Yet optimism persists. Perhaps because in even the worst of times, our predecessors always raised a maypole for themselves and their children to dance around. Perhaps in especially the worst times, it is necessary to hope. And that was May Day. Now I'd like to read The Sprays of Spring, which, again, I wrote, and my disclaimer holds. And a quote from Rachel Carson. The chemical war is never won, and all life is caught in its crossfire. Sweet spring, buds, blooms, and blossoms, sounds of birds and crop dusters, skies shot with billowy clouds and mists of pesticides. The eternal war against insects and weeds is renewed. We are dusted, misted, sprayed, hosed, and powdered with some of the deadliest chemicals ever conceived. To kill pickle worms, aphids, leafhoppers, spider mites, cabbage worms, spittle bugs, potato beetles, carpenter ants, Japanese beetles, corn earworms, grasshoppers, coddling moths, blister beetles, and unwanted plants, fungi, and weeds, we are exposed to insecticides, miticides, acaricides, nematicides, fungicides, bactericides, avicides, herbicides, rodenticides, piscicides, molluscicides, and predicides, plus desiccants and defoliants. These pesticides kill by simply touching insects. They kill when swallowed or by being taken into the blood of animals or the sap of plants. They kill through inhalation or by being otherwise absorbed. Selective pesticides are designed to kill only certain kinds of plants, insects, or animals. Non-selective pesticides kill most plants, insects, and animals. These chemicals are dropped by airplanes, sprayed from tanks on trucks, from knapsack containers, hoses, and handheld sprayers. They are dusted, misted, or sprayed over farms, forests, and gardens, and are also used on school playgrounds, golf courses, the lawns of public buildings, and along roadsides. They drift in forms of dust and mist or move with soil particles by erosion. They leach through the soil into streams, rivers, and lakes and are carried as residues on crops and livestock or evaporate and move with air currents. Of course, we are not only assaulted by pesticides from air, land, and water. We eat and drink them also in fruits, vegetables, meats, and milk. 1 billion pounds of these poisons are applied annually within the United States, and it is virtually impossible to live anywhere in the country without being exposed, in many areas saturated. Wildlife is contaminated, food chains are affected, habitat is destroyed, and human life is endangered. Pesticides are linked to cancer, nervous system damage, degenerative changes in liver and kidneys, fetal injury, miscarriages, birth defects, genetic mutations, and other serious diseases. Pesticides occur in mother's milk and in the tissues of unborn children. Exposure to these chemicals causes irreversible changes that alter genetic material in cells permanently. Pesticide residues and their breakdown products are routinely found in blood and urine samples from both urban and rural residents nationwide. Pesticide residues capable of causing cancer and mutations show up in human sperm samples. In 1987, the National Academy of Sciences released a study that concluded that 28 pesticides capable of causing cancer and have been found in foods might cause more than 1 million cancers over the next 70 years. And a private environmental group, the Natural Resources Defense Council, reports that children's exposure to pesticides and potential harm from these chemicals in food is 6 to 12 times greater than that of adults. Rachel Carson, who sounded the alarm about the dangers of pesticides 50 years ago in her 1961 book, Silent Spring, called these poisons biocides. There are two kinds of biocides, botanical or organic, and synthetic or human-made. Though the first are dangerous enough, powdered arsenic has been used for centuries and has a significant death toll, the synthetic chemicals are unsurpassed in their toxicity. Initial development of these chemicals was during World War II, following the discovery of DDT. Ironically, the growth of the synthetic pesticide industry started in the war years by testing these chemicals on insects as possible agents to kill human enemies. And that's during World War II. The government regulatory process is a failure as much in pesticide abuse as Pentagon contracts. The political and commercial copulative relationship between agencies and industry rules out any effectively honest regulation of pesticide use and abuse. In fact, government agencies rely on manufacturers' data about pesticide safety with the ingenuous claim the process saves taxpayers money. Other information about toxicity levels or research is either suppressed or is often falsified. The standard used by both government and industry is a so-called safe level of toxicity, though it has been determined that there is no safe level of exposure to anything that causes cancer or mutations, which is used short of outright banning of a substance and is generally assumed to not cause immediate alarm or harm. As these chemicals are new, when first labeled, there is no method of determining long-range or cumulative effects than wait and see. Even when a chemical is harmful to test animals, industry and government officials say they cannot be sure they are harmful to humans. Labeling information is itself suspect, particularly claims that a pesticide is safe or that its ingredients are non-poisonous. The Environmental Protection Agency has banned only three pesticides since it was established in 1970 and has seriously restricted the use of only a handful of others. Even so, whenever a substance is banned or restricted, unrestricted use of stocks on hand are usually allowed to be sold and used, while a number of other equally toxic chemicals that are in the wait-and-see stage are put into use as replacements. Chemicals that are singled out as a result of harmful effects are seldom equated with the multiple effects of cumulative exposure to dozens of pesticides, often simultaneously. Not only has the ingenious development of synthetic pesticides outrun the knowledge of their disastrous effects on living organisms, but residues from their manufacture accumulate in largely unregulated dumps where some break down into even deadlier compounds that seep into land, water, and air. Carol Van Strum of Five Forks, Oregon, in her 1983 book, A Bitter Fog, Herbicides and Human Rights, echoed a call by Rachel Carson for a constitutional amendment to protect citizens from environmental poisoning. To those who bear the risk, she wrote, exposure to poisons is a matter of life and death. Decisions about poisons which disrupt the basic mechanisms of life and the biological integrity of future generations raise profound moral questions. Society cannot afford to entrust such decisions to corporations or political entities that exempt themselves from the restraints of morality and ethics. And that's a quote by Carol Van Strum. Under present law, a citizen threatened with exposure to a toxic chemical is required to prove that irreparable harm will result, while the information necessary for such proof is kept secret or not available because adequate research has not been done, not to mention revisions of studies that are watered down to support the chemical industry. Van Strum believes, quote, that a society insisting on its right to informed consent would quickly redirect pest control toward non-poisonous methods of integrated pest management. Pest control, she writes, would adopt nature's system of checks and balances essential to a true democracy. Rachel Carson said that the only reason the Bill of Rights contains no guarantees that a citizen should be secure against lethal poisons distributed whether by private individuals or government officials is because our forefathers, despite their considerable wisdom and foresight, could conceive of no such problem. An informed consent amendment is already provided a constitutional basis by the Ninth Amendment, which states that in addition to the specific rights enumerated by the Constitution, there are, quote, others retained by the people, unquote. History, however, has shown that specific rights must necessarily be specified if they are to be upheld. Nothing could be more specific than two questions posed by Van Strum. Do I or do I not have the right to know the effects of the stuff you intend to expose me to? Do you or do you not have to get my permission before exposing me to it? A constitutional amendment would not be an instant or complete solution to the problems of pesticides, and government and industry will spend millions of dollars fighting it. But as Van Strum says, in opposing informed consent, government and industry would have to admit that toxic exposure does occur and that people have no right either to know about it or stop it. They would have to convince the public that ignorance and helplessness are preferable to knowledge and control. In the meantime, the insects we attempt to eradicate continue to build resistance to pesticides, which cause development of ever more toxic chemicals. For humans to build resistance will take hundreds of generations, at roughly 3 generations a century. New insect generations occur in a matter of days or weeks. The chemical control of plants and insects turns out to be a greater menace to ourselves than to its targets. Future historians may well be amazed by our own distorted sense of proportion, Rachel Carson wrote in Silent Spring. How could intelligent beings seek to control an unwanted species by a method that contaminated the entire environment and brought the threat of disease and death even to their own kind? And that was Silent Spring. And I would like to thank Rachel Carson and Carol Van Strum, and also Mary Sellen and Dee Mayatel of Ocean and Helen Hill, whose articles in the North Coast Times Eagle provided essential research for this article. And now I'd like to read something else I wrote, which is also covered by the disclaimer, The Virgins of Spring. And a quote from Maurice Chevalier, Thank Heaven for Little Girls. Spring, time for the ritual festivals of fertility, the interminable spectacles of middle-aged men of various paternal orders fawning over the season's young princesses while obliterating any resemblance to the former carnality of these annual rites. Humanity's biological clock does not keep the same time as its intellectual designs. We are pagan savages underneath our surface dust of civilized society. Our ancient fertility rites are layered in antiseptic disguises that reflect a rigidly puritanical and sexually repressed culture, despite MTV and the movies. Our libertine male ancestors, elders of various tribes or clans, demanded first crack at every spring's virgins, and later, within reach of our own era, noblesse oblige gave a local baron the right to consummate a marriage with the virgin bride of a peasant. Old bulls in the natural world fight young stags for intercourse dominance over a plurality of females. Old bulls in the contrived human world compete with hair implants and sporty automobiles. Older men have always wanted to mate with young girls, not from nostalgia for lost youth, but to consolidate aging and vitiated genes with strong, robust genes, maintaining a vigorous stock by minimizing the disadvantages of worn-out RNA. Although the desire for young lambs is socially degenerate, it reflects age-old lusts and determination to survive through greater genetic diaspora. However, for the same reason, older men strive to preserve their reproductive vitality and biological imperative. Few younger women are willing to risk vitiating their own genetic possibilities with old dogs past their prime. After all, young men are strong bulls yet and offer the best opportunity for sturdy stock. As a woman once wrote, sperm is cheap, eggs are expensive. The sexual desire of older men and women for girls and boys is an insensate desire, a primeval siren's call to invigorate reproductivity. However, like individual cells, each person's purposes and depravities are their own. Children throughout history have been initiated early to sex, more often as not by adults. Only recently has society prolonged sexual abstinence, just as it has prolonged childhood itself and life. Laws and social restrictions are designed to prevent promiscuous older persons from debauching children, especially to keep predatory males off the bodies of young girls until they grow old enough to make their own choices of mates. Most older people, in consequence, stifle their sexual desires for the young in fear of social disapproval and legal vengeance, and sublimate them in other ways. But those who do not are very often explosive with their thwarted desires and become deviant and violent in pursuit of them. The strictures that attempt to protect children are quite likely perpetrators of the grotesque molestation and sexual murders of children. Pornography, promiscuity, and pedophilia are results of sexual repression and are in turn demanded to be suppressed. A civilization out of control breeds violence and insecurity, which is taken out on children by neurotic, bitter adults. Movies, documentaries, groups of parents, and others throughout the country advocate for laws for greater protection of children, yet abuse flourishes underground. From a Time magazine article about pop rock star Michael Jackson's alleged fellatio with a 13-year-old boy, quote, "The allegation also speaks to the modern preoccupation with child abuse. In an age when lurid lyrics, sniggering sitcoms, and trash-talking stars work hard to rob children of innocence, the sexually abusive parent, guardian, or family friend is not only a predator in his own right, but also a stand-in for all the gaudy malevolence of pop culture. The public reacts with wide eyes and a bit of drool at the corner of the mouth." The article quoted a psychologist who was also a lawyer. Quote, "The public gets to be puritanical and voyeuristic at the same time. Their attitude is basically, this food is terrible and there's not enough of it." For thousands of years, it was acceptable for adults to have sexual relations with children, with a few exceptions such as Native American cultures, which regarded child sexual abuse as a capital crime. Only recently has the interest in child sexual abuse opened a campaign to prevent and punish it, and in particular to warn and protect children. Child abuse and neglect are now claimed to be major sources of crime and international wars. "Sexual offenders will tell you who they are by what they do," says an attorney involved in abuse cases. "Child molesters do what they want to do, and do it over and over again. They do not serially abuse children because they are depraved, but because they have the opportunity. Prison time does not change a molester's attraction for children, and eventually they get out of jail. In a number of states, child molesters who have served their sentences are being kept behind bars, which is unconstitutional and which many believe addresses a flaw in the legal system through the back door. Convicted child abusers are also targeted with emblems that identify them as molesters once released from prison, in the manner of early American colonial Puritans who publicly marked sexual deviance. Yet the problem remains. What should be done with child molesters who will commit such acts again and again? The manner in which child abuse is treated drives predators underground and into more violent acts. Following a long period of neglect, public antipathy toward child abuse, whether sexual or violent or both, has swung to the extreme, making almost any adult contact with children suspect, which only severs necessary connections between generations that will most likely do greater harm to society, such as the current fearful strictures of personal contact between teachers and students. One woman expressed eloquently the public's inflamed anger at the surge of child molestation. "If anyone messed with my daughter," she said, "I would nail his penis to a stump in the middle of the woods, set the stump afire, hand him a rusty axe, and walk away." So we sanitize our public sexual ceremonies in the same manner we act unconscious of the implications of dressing little girls to resemble women and dress older women as prepubescents. We are, however, a contradictory species. At the same instant we arouse the ancient lust for young girls and or boys, we act aggressively against child molestation. We ruthlessly strip the ancient fertility festivals of overt carnality, while older men pantomime with much flair and flim-flam the covert seduction of ceremonial queens selected from among virgin princesses to rule imaginary courts of spring, Scandinavia, roses, or regatta. Only fools and hypocrites deny the attractions of the beautiful young. Young women and men are among the grandest creatures on earth. We all love youth, reproductively, restoratively, and retrospectively. The distinctions between abusive touching of our young and loving, caring touches are necessary for all of us to know. Dreams and attractions are out of our control. Our responses to them are not. And that was The Virgins of Spring. And this concludes this particular half hour. And I am Michael McCusker. I might be back next week, and I might not be.